good bill.
That's great.
What number?
The table didn't come already on the bar. I like it better.
Okay. How come we only got one book? You empty? Boy, you got empty.
Well, that's a good deal.
But you didn't take all the past bills out?
That's what I thought, thank you. I just threw it away.
You didn't think I was just gonna stick to one book, did you?
I'm not sure, I don't know what you're doing.
You were wrong.
Well, what do you think?
Hello.
What's the number of bills?
Are you bouncing back?
Oh, boy.
Are you?
Here's in front of the house, meaning what's going on.
Well, I need to send somebody else.
Hey, you rascal, you better send me a letter about my advice, you never did that.
Did you reach an agreement?
Well, you told me on the phone you did, but you never sent me a, I don't know what's been...
On this?
No.
I had to leave town.
I'd like the committee...
We just got the amendment finished this morning.
I'd like the committee's approval to put in a bill. In the summons section, it still refers to suits for divorce, and it would simply change it to suits for dissolution. Okay? Mr. Johnson?
Which bill are we on?
163, it's in this packet that you have here.
Okay,
Madam Chairman, member of the committee, I was not at your last meeting, but was reported back to me the results. And Senator Hoyt has called me, two or three days ago and asked me for my views on this question of opting in and opting out under Senate Bill 163. And, I said at the time I wasn't really quite sure what my position was, and let me talk to some people, and I did talk to both the legal aid representatives, Charlie Williamson and Laird Kirkpatrick, and some of the industry representatives, particularly Mr. O'Leary.
That's Prentice O'Leary from Los Angeles.
Right, right. Then following your meeting, they all came back to my office and we talked for a while, and it looked to me like really that they were pretty close to agreement, or they could be brought fairly close to agreement. So I asked them all that night to go prepare a draft of what they suggested, and let's get together the following morning. And we did get together the following morning, and we did finally come up with a amendment, which I don't think I could honestly say that everybody is totally satisfied with, but I think all of those parties that were in attendance felt they could live with, which is maybe an indication that it's a pretty good provision. I do want to make this qualification, though, that the I did receive a call this morning from Mr. Hugh Biggs, who represents, I think it's the U.S. National, whether he's representing all the banks, I'm not sure in this manner. They are not in agreement. They do not feel that this provision goes far enough. And I did indicate to them that I would ask the chairman to give them an opportunity to present their views, maybe possibly at another meeting if you think it's appropriate. Basically, well, I'll explain their position as I get into it. Now, the amendments I have submitted to you, after we had gotten some agreement over this opt-in and opt-out, it was agreed we would redo all the amendments into one single package, which would include, and if you'll note, these are have letters next to each paragraph. Those that are lettered A are the amendments that were have been agreed upon by all the parties, and you had adopted. B were the amendments that were proposed by AOI and that the committee had already adopted. And then C, were the compromise amendments we worked out? D, are some technical and conforming amendments, which we have checked out with all the parties, everybody's in agreement on. I will then just address myself to those that are lettered C. And basically, this is on
starts at 2, it looks like.
Yeah, it's this new sub 2. And what it does, as far as the opt-in, opt-out situation goes, is it leaves the opt-out as it is and adds this qualifying language, which in effect requires some kind of a statement by the members of the class that would have to be submitted prior to the entry of a judgment. Now, the court is given some flexibility as to time, but all the parties agree that it would be contemplated. It would be far down the line in the proceeding, probably after the findings have been made by the court, but before the entry of the final judgment. Likewise, we've given the court complete flexibility in devising the type of form, because it was the feeling of everybody that you just cannot, these class action cases, you really have to deal with them on an individual basis. We have tried to enumerate, though, the considerations that the defendant, that the court, pardon me, has to take into consideration in determining the form of the notice that would be required from each member of the class. Then we provided that if a member of the class fails to file a statement, then it's grounds for entry of a judgment of dismissing his claim, but it's a dismissal without prejudice as to his individual claim. It would be a dismissal with prejudice as to bringing any class action. And that is the guts of this. I think what it really breaks down, what it really boils down to, and the essential compromise that was made here, our essential understanding is that the principal objection of at least the retailers, their principal concern is what we call the fluid recovery theory. And these amendments definitely would not permit the fluid recovery theory. Legal aid was very amenable to that. I should say that also Mr. Carey was represented in some class actions in a private capacity, was not in on these meetings. I don't know whether he would go along with this, but I just want to make it clear who was there and who wasn't there. I think this is frankly, reviewing the bill over today, I think it's a very good bill with these amendments.
Senator White.
I thought when I first read the amendments that we adopted the other day, the first two amendments that involved the court in some discretionary capacities, I thought that kind of took care of the thing. Then they said, no, you got to have the opt-in and out separately. My question is, why couldn't what you have in sub 2, the intent of that, be at the beginning of the bill instead of after the whole show is on the road?
Well, I think basic point, you go back to the opt-in, opt-out. If you go to an opt-in provision, I think you effectively probably preclude many legitimate type of class actions.
Now that's my point. If I understand, if you put this suggested amendment at the beginning of the bill instead of the end, then the judge can make the decision of whether it's somebody that should be in is kept out. Do you want to make my point?
You want to eliminate trivial.
Well, you have a provision in here, and I can't point to the amendment. For example, if the judge determines that the claims are minimal, the case is out. That's one of the amendments they agreed upon. Yeah, it's on the first page there, which I think is a very good amendment.
Well, but part of that, Madam Chairman, doesn't this come as I read these amendments, if I read them correctly, these matters come up at the very end of the procedure, not at the beginning. Now, does E come in at the beginning of the action?
Well, the first part, okay, you have a notice that goes out at the beginning of the action that says you are included in the class unless you submit a notice saying you want to get out of the class. That's the way the bill provides with these amendments. And then, prior to the entry of the judgment, then you have a notice in accordance with this section, which will require, could require quite a bit of detail, could require a complete statement of your claim, a detailed claim of what you're basing your damages on, depending upon the circumstances. One of the principal circumstances, which we mentioned here, is who is in the best position to determine how much of it, the damages the member of the class has suffered. In some cases, for example, the case I always comes to my mind is the debt reducers case. There's no question the company's records would have been the easiest place to determine who the class members were and to determine how much damage they suffered. It was a clear case of a statutory overcharge. On the other hand, you take a case like the case that we are pursuing, the drug case, which is part of a national litigation that's going on, but we're all ultimate purchasers. We're representing not only the state of Oregon, but the citizens of the state of Oregon as ultimate purchasers. Obviously, the drug companies do not have the records of who they sold these drugs to. Those records are down the distribution line a number of places, so the claims are going to have to be made by the individual. The claimants, you're going to have detailed claimants from them. Another factor which is in here, which I think is very important, is what is, which the court can take into consideration, is what is the degree of sophistication of the class? Case, for example, the commercial lending case, the 300...
Excuse me, now, this is my point. Looks like this determination of sophistication of the class ought to be one of the first things that are considered under the procedure. Rather than last, after you've made the decision,
I think the way it is now is they have to determine the class to begin with. Is that right, Charlie?
Yeah, as soon as the case is brought.
You got to make it, right.
Well, the line E here, this E amendment comes on line 16, which is the end of the bill.
Let me say this. Most of these findings that have to be made under C, likewise have to be made initially by the court in determining the class.
Right.
There's a little difference in the standards, but not immeasurably. Those are set out in the bill. Those are your section 2, sub 2.
Charlie, do you want to point out too? I don't think it is in this book, is it? Are you looking for one? These guys looking one for notes.
He's looking at the bill, I'm just looking at the amendment.
You go through...
Well, the bill is in the packet, too.
Oh, excuse me.
All right. Dick, in section 2, he's got to determine, is the class and numerous, the joinder of all the members is impractical? Are there questions of fact and law that are common to the class? Are the defenses common to the class? Will the parties be fairly represented in a class action? Would the requiring separate actions end up with a bunch of inconsistent decisions? And then we have added some of these. What are these? Well, one is the likelihood of damages to be recovered by individual class members if judgment for the class is entered are so minimal as not to warrant the intervention by the court. The probability of sustaining the claim is minimal. This all has to be determined at the outset.
Oh, I'm sorry, I misread this. I thought this was all in at the end. The end of it.
No, this is at the end. This is to take care of the situation. Okay, you determine that there is essentially liability. Now it is to identify really much more specifically who is going to get paid and how much are they going to get paid.
This is determined before that you have the argument about whether they owe or not. Is that right?
Right. And if you have, for example, you've got an opt-out class, suppose it turns out the number of those members are either deceased or no longer in existence, they would not file these notices at the end. They would not get damages, and likewise, there's no fluid recovery, which is just this big residue that goes to some charity or some other type of thing. Under these amendments, there would be no fluid recovery.
Other questions, Mr. Johnson? Williams, do you want to make any comments?
I think that the amendment salvage a workable bill.
Let me make one comment, Senator, if I could. I was very impressed with the people who were involved in this. The high degree of statesmanship I thought that was exercised by everyone made some agreement possible, at least some rational discussion possible.
Madam Chairman.
Yes.
There have been some changes here in some of the minutes we made, right? Some corrections and stuff, right?
Yeah, that's the ones that are marked.
But everything here, every amendment we have passed to the original bill is included in this. Is that right?
Right, right.
Every amendment.
Those are A and B.
So we're starting with the bare bill.
Yeah.
We have to have a motion to withdraw all previous amendments and move these.
Yeah.
I so move.
Discussion. Now, let me ask you, did Mr. Biggs specifically ask to be heard on this? He hasn't contacted me.
Yes. Well, he called me at 12 noon today. I think he had just, he said that frankly he had a different understanding of what we had reached agreement over, and he had just received a copy, or actually gotten a hold of, I think Charlie delivered them yesterday, but apparently he had just gotten a chance to take a look at them.
Madam Chairman, excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Madam Chairman, it seems to me the only way you can do anything more to satisfy the people who are generally opposed to this bill is to have an optimum procedure. I mean, that's the next step. So it's whether we have a bill at all or not is what we're talking about. And all due respect to Mr. Biggs, we know what he's going to say when he comes down here. He's going to say he wants an opt-in procedure. He's already told us that, and I have a great deal of respect for him, but I just don't see any reason to have him come down here and tell us that.
Are you able to testify on these amendments?
Not really. I think the Attorney General and Charlie understand them, and I was not really party to the last meeting.
Have you read them, Tom?
I've read most of them.
And do you want to make any statement?
I think all Tom's got a problem. I think
I do have
some of his clients.
Some of my clients are on one side. Some of my clients are on the other.
All right, I don't see you.
And you're your clients.
Well, it goes further. It definitely cuts off fluid recovery. It is an opt-out, but it requires a notice prior to entry of judgment.
Well, the old
closes the class.
The old federal rule was the opt-in. Then they changed it in 56 or whatever, and took out the opt-in and has the opt-out, if I'm not mistaken. Now,
right.
Does this, without regard to fluid recovery, conform to the federal rule with respect to the opt-in and opt-out?
Right.
Is that your intent, Charlie?
It does, except it goes before judgment can be entered, it's opt-in. It's opt-out for making the class,
right.
But then in determining who's going to get any damages, they have to opt in to get the damages.
All right, so
it requires
that extent,
an affirmative action.
So to that extent, it's more restrictive than the federal rule,
right?
All right, now may I ask another question?
Yeah, sure.
I continue to be very much concerned about the absence of the subsidiary and ancillary types of procedures which we have under the federal rules, which we don't have under our code. And I've asked this question every time y'all have been here. You haven't been here before, but you know this. But where are we on summary judgment? Where are we on interlocutory appeals? Where are we on the complex multi-jurisdictional procedure that you have that helps to resolve these?
They've got sections in there as part of these amendments, John, that certainly meet some of those problems. They have a semi-summary judgment proceedings on questions of law that basically the court can determine whether there is any liability on certain issues at the outset without even having to try to identify the class or anything else, just to see what the guy's got in his suit. What was the other one I had in mind? The
interlocutory appeal.
That's
included. Where is that, Charlie?
And they have actions for coordination of proceedings.
Section 22.
Where you got a number of these filed at once.
Why do you have district judge in section 22?
District or circuit court judge.
The district court's going to have jurisdiction of class action?
Well, they do now in class suits. And so I didn't want to restrict their jurisdiction. I don't think that anyone would bring a class suit or action in district court, but we didn't see there's any reason to curtail their jurisdiction.
We'd appeal right from the district court to the court of appeals
if they certify it.
Bob, the motion before the committee is to repeal all former amendments, and this is in your packet. I mean, Senate Bill 163. Repeal all former amendments and take the original bill and adopt the Attorney General's amendments.
Yep. Madam Chairman, could I just make one comment?
You're going to make a disclaimer?
No. John, I agree with you. It probably would be better if we had this total federal rule package, but I think they have addressed themselves, probably most of the problems, and have provided procedures here to take care of them where the federal rules are handy.
Well, in addition, I might mention that we have the bill on the committee which the House passed, which would give the Supreme Court ruling.
And
I don't know how the committee's going on that, but we do have it.
Starting to get mail from lawyers on that. All right, I have one other question, and that is, Madam Chairman, the attorney fees section. Which one is that?
Well, we've not. I'll say this, John, that I would be a little bit careful if the court just simply adopted the federal rules, including just Rule 23. I think this is a much better job than Rule 23.
All right. To that extent, I certainly do agree. No question about it.
It's on page 4.
Yes, I see it now.
Am I correct, Charlie, that even after the court determines the class or decides any of these preliminary issues, those are all appealable, aren't they?
Yes, and in fact, the court can change its mind on any of these preliminary issues that specifically state.
Okay. Question?
Well, he's explaining it to Bob. Further discussion or question?
We adopt all of the big amendments last meeting.
Yes, we did. And the motion before us now is to repeal all the amendments. We had adopted two sets, one that they had agreed upon and one that was a fix. And the motion is to repeal totally all amendments, take the original bill, and adopt the Attorney General's.
And the effect of that would be to, by the Attorney General's amendments, the effect of that would be to adopt the agreed upon amendments.
Yes.
And not the Biggs amendments, which they didn't.
No, who are the Biggs amendments?
That's the first thing.
Yeah. What we're talking about is the opt-in, opt-out procedure. That's the only thing we're changing about these amendments.
Yeah.
And then it isn't a total rejection of the
outstanding. Yeah,
I thought that this was the fact of the whole bill now. The first two big amendments are in here now?
Yep.
That's what I thought.
There is the main amendment.
That's important. My real concern is the judge makes his decision before they go to a hell of a lot of expense. And
well, he does. Dick, he does. He determines what the class is going to be, whether there's going to be a suit at all, the cause of action at all. He makes all those determinations right at the beginning of the lawsuit. All this does is, assuming the class prevails and they get a recovery, they're awarded, they're going to give them a judgment. All this does is says that, say they got $1 million that they shouldn't have, unless somebody says definitely, I want my share as awarded by this judgment. Unless they say that, they don't have to get back this money they stole.
Do they get notice that this is coming to them?
Huh?
Do they get notice it's coming to them?
Yes.
Senator Ivers.
Well, I was just wondering about this note, what he brought up. You go through the whole darn case and then have to send out notice. The guy might be entitled to $1 a piece.
No, that's all determined. The judge, there's a, in here, the judge...
I know, but it's minimal.
So minimal,
okay,
for a person,
say,
the judge can
okay,
say no.
It's a little more, maybe even $10 or so. You might not be able to reach all those people.
Well,
and then the very fact, then, even though they have recovered the verdict, then unless they file an affirmative statement, they're going to be out of it.
Charlie?
In a case like that, which was essentially the same as the Eisen case, which Mr. O'Leary brought, the judge would find that the case is unmanageable, even under the existing rule, without any amendments. The courts have found cases like that are simply unmanageable and can't be maintained. And manageability is one of the standards that you have to maintain now in federal court to bring class action.
Now, if they don't come in affirmatively, they can still maintain a separate action. Except
individual
class action, but their own individual action.
Oh, that's all right.
There's been a motion to move the bill to the floor, do pass as amended. Discussion.
Well, I'll explain my vote afterwards.
Clerk, call
the
roll.
Senator John Brand?
No.
Senator Keith Brand?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Ivers?
No.
Senator Hoyt?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
No.
Madam Chairman, aye.
I think it's a much, much better bill, and, insofar as it conforms to the existing federal rule with respect to the opt-in, opt-out, and that's fine. But I'm still hung, most of these cases are settled, resolved on subsidiary-type motions, which are possible under the flexibility that we have in the federal rules, and the broadened discovery that we have, which we don't have. And it's that procedural thing that bothers me. I have the idea that it's probably a pretty good bill, and it's a fair bill, and I think that these outfits should get stuck for the extent to which they take advantage of particularly poor people. But because I have that bother, I feel better with the no vote.
Madam Chairman.
Bill, yeah.
If I might.
Yes.
There is still some disagreement, I'm afraid. But I'm wondering whether it would be possible to, before you release the committee report, to have the bill engrossed and give people who have been concerned about it and let them see the bill in the final form in the hope that perhaps they might come together on this thing. I grant that the other side of it is that if there's opposition to it, it gives more time to the opposition to work against the bill. But I think it might be helpful if people who are very gravely concerned with the form of the bill to have a chance to see it and really reflect on the bill in its printed form, because really a lot of people haven't seen the amendments. This has gone fairly rapidly.
I'll give Mr. Biggs a call. Is that who you're concerned about?
There are probably more than Mr. Biggs.
Well, would Mr.
Probably
Biggs
ought to call Hank Carey too.
That'll ensure that the bill passes. I'll hold all my votes.
I'll call Mr. Fury also then.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Let's turn to House Bill 2918.
What bill are we on, ready?
2918.
Madam Chairman, Leonard Skinner, I'm the staff member of the Board on Police Standards and Training.
Pardon me, I don't. Who's your employer?
Board on Police Standards and Training.
Oh, Board of Police. Yes, I saw it.
Leo was unable to attend today, so I'll be speaking on his behalf. We do favor passage of this bill. We feel it is needed for the small cities under 1,000 population. Passage of the bill would not create any undue hardship for it because we're speaking of a very small number of people. Most of the cities under 1,000 right now that have police departments have been complying with the minimum funding standards on a voluntary basis.
You only have one.
So this will make it applicable to cities under 1,000, whereas it's not now.
Sure.
And an elected sheriff. You know, Madam Chairman,
Yes, Senator.
One of the things that I ran into recently, and it came out all right, but it could have been very troublesome, was the question of a possible conflict between these standards and the city charter. And I wonder if anyone has ever sought to, and it has nothing to do with this particular provision, but I know that we had a situation in my favorite city.
What's the name of it?
Troutdale. Where just yesterday morning, my associate won because they filed a written review too late. I don't know how it would have happened in the merits.
involved
a possible conflict between these standards on the one hand and the city charter on the other, which purported to give to the mayor the authority to discharge for stating the reason, whereas I think in these standards, before you can discharge, I believe, you have to give a written notice or some sort of thing. Minimum. I'm not sure if it's in these standards.
No, this pertains just to the training aspect here.
Yeah.
Well, what about service? Now, isn't this a part of the overall standards relative to municipal?
Yes, the municipal agency could still discharge at their pleasure.
Well,
these
are
certain minimum standards for eligibility.
Except that probation provisions.
Yeah.
And doesn't that relate to discharge?
It doesn't take away anything from the municipality at all, the way it's written.
Well,
they are free to hire and fire as long as the man's minimum qualifications are expected to come under here on the hard part.
Two standards.
For the question, George Ivers.
What happens if the sheriff is elected and he doesn't qualify?
I believe this was voted on last November, that he must
be disqualified from office then, huh?
He is ineligible to run.
Well, what happens? He has to qualify before he runs.
Yes.
Well, this would delete that, wouldn't it?
No.
No, he's exempt now.
No, he isn't.
Yes, he is.
Under this bill, he's exempt, but under the existing law, because he had a sheriff in Wheeler County who was elected in November, and he didn't have the minimum standards, and so what happened was the outgoing sheriff resigned before January 1st in order that that the incoming guy would be exempt. But under the present law, if you're elected and you don't have the minimum standards, then you can't serve. But this would put in an exemption.
This was actually in conflict with because of the older nature of it.
Under this section, he was exempt, but not under the thing that was passed last November.
Well, what was passed last November?
Was it a constitutional amendment?
Yeah. Sheriff and assessor or something.
So, okay, status for sheriffs, and then this
they must have 5 years of experience, or they must have an equivalent.
This was in conflict with that, and so what we're doing is being consistent with, is that right?
Well, we're doing something else.
No.
We're saying that the minimum standards do not apply.
That's right. Under 640 do not apply.
That's
the training standards. 640 says you
are you reading out of the Constitution?
I'm reading out of 640, which is a training standards under this.
And it doesn't apply to an elected sheriff.
Well, that's what the law is now.
Right, and we're deleting that exemption.
Therefore, it does apply.
Sure.
Yes, yes, it does
right.
apply.
I think it's in conflict with what we did.
Never going to be copied.
I think it's consistent with what we did in November.
What we did,
we added to the...
November wasn't a constitutional amendment?
Right.
Yes, it was.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you had to have 5 years.
Yeah. So this would affect that.
The only thing that you're doing is deleting things.
Well, Madam Chairman, let me ask a question.
Yes.
And on line 16, what you're doing is you're adding all police officers in cities under a population of 1,000 to the same kinds of standards as all other policemen have in the city.
Yep.
And under the minimum standards in 640, 181640. Okay, now why do you want to do that?
Because we feel that these cities need to have trained police officers as well as larger communities.
Now, aren't many of these cities already training their police officers?
Most of them have been voluntarily participating with the Minimum Standards Act.
Now, do you know of any cities are having trouble finding police officers? And should we pass this bill, that it may be impossible for them to find police officers who have served?
Two-part question. Some cities are having problems finding police officers.
Yes.
If this bill is passed, it may create a little additional hardship in some cases. I wouldn't be aware of any specific example.
Well, Madam Chairman, I suppose I represent most of the cities under 1,000 in the state. I would really like to talk to the man who represents cities, Don, what's his name?
Don Jones.
Okay.
Let's find out how this may affect them. I don't mind us encouraging cities to train the police officers. That's really not the point.
But I think you've got a good point.
There's a lot of difficulties finding police officers, and they pay them nothing, as you probably know. And if we can couch this in words of encouragement, or we can change it from May to Shall to May or something.
I think the thing that you need to be concerned about and ought to ask about are the small cities that don't have really a police officer but just have a town marshal. Maybe all he does is enforce a licensing requirement or something like that in the most minimal way. And there's a question whether that person should have to have any training at all.
A lot of times there wasn't to collect the water bills.
They also collect the water bills and the nuisance ordinances and that sort of
part of the regular
just a minute. John, we sat down for another hearing as soon as possible with Don Jones present. Now, we do have other witnesses. Are there further questions of this witness? Thank you, sir. Mr. Dickinson?
Madam Chairman, I defer to Sheriff Barnes. He represents the same group that I came here to.
Very good.
Madam Chairman, I'm representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association on behalf of Johnny Truth, Sheriff of Edwards County. I was given very short notice of being here. I would like to say that the Oregon State Sheriff's Association endorses this wholeheartedly. We see no conflict in item B, an individual who is, by deleting an elected sheriff or marshal. We have no grace period to worry about now because the first election has been, or the first of the year has been over with, and those sheriffs who were having trouble are all in office. We lost no sheriffs because of the other law, and we feel that there's no reason to have this in here when we've got a state law voted on by the people of the state of Oregon to set standards for us. That was done by the sheriffs themselves, that bill. Under item F of serving cities of population of 1,000 or less, I would like to bring it to the attention of this committee that these people do not have to be certified until they've worked for 1 year. During that period of time, these cities are reimbursed to hire part-time people to take the place of these people while they're at the academy. And all we're trying to do is see to it that when you get pinched, or I get pinched, in some city, we have the opportunity to at least know that we were arrested by somebody who has an idea of what he's doing. Now, we have no objections to the man reading water meters while he's a police officer, if he has the training that he's supposed to have. And I'll tell you, with the Supreme Court decisions and the things that are coming down, there are certain rights that I feel people should be taught, instructed on, and know about before they go out there with their gun on their hip, whether they're water meter readers representing the city or not. And
we needed you on Senate Bill 80.
Oh, I've got my doubts on that one. some areas. For Washington County had requirements to make my position. I'm elected, but to set down the fact that I have had to be certified by the Board on Police Center Training or anyone who ran against me before this state law ever went into effect. It's worked very well in my county, and I know it's going to work very well in the city. We're trying to upgrade ourselves, and we're also trying to see to it that the cities upgrade themselves to protect you people who are going to be arrested in those cities.
How are you on blue lights for police?
We got them in. I haven't had a police car run into since we put blue lights on by anyone who's colorblind.
I know. The question was raised about a city having a population of 1,000. And I noticed that that really relates also to this language, the marshal. And maybe that wouldn't be a problem if we left in the word marshal. Because do you think I'm right in this theory that those cities, they either small cities, and you have a number of them, I'm sure, in Washington County, where they don't have a police officer, they'll have a marshal, don't they? I mean, there needs to be someone. You don't have authority as the county sheriff, for example. Nor, I think, unless we gave it to them by statute, nor does anyone else have authority to arrest for violation of a city ordinance.
I do under contract.
But only under contract.
Yes, sir.
Now, if there weren't a contract, however, you need somebody in these small cities who can arrest for these minor violations of city ordinances. They really don't need, I mean, maybe they only make one arrest a year or three. It's really kind of a waste of time, isn't it, to require them to take the training to meet the minimum standards for police officers.
That's not a waste of time, sir, because it may be you that's arrested and you, there may have been a problem that you don't agree with.
Well, you have, Madam Chairman,
sure.
you have, since you're from Washington County, you have probably the most despicable situation in your county, of any state, in any county in the state, with respect to the situation in North Plains. Those police, I have a case right now in the Washington County Court involving a crime committed out there. But that
part-time grocery clerk that drives around in the police car out there that doesn't even get paid, knows about as much about law enforcement as my 9-year-old boy. You don't have to comment on that, but if I understand your support of this bill, it would require people in towns over 1,000 to have training, but it wouldn't affect a town like North Plains.
All cities.
All cities.
This would change to all cities.
All cities. I think it's a good bill.
Yes. I would like to comment in regards to this.
I thought you were going to write that.
The illustration that you gave is exactly the reason I'm here, and I feel so strong on this, because I've had to help bail these people out before, and I'm about, if we can't train them, why should we help?
Well, you know, Madam Chair,
yeah.
I go one step further. I believe that the county sheriff should handle the law enforcement responsibilities for all the cities in the county under contractual arrangement with the cities. I think that's being done in Linn County, if I'm not mistaken, and I think it's working out pretty well.
I have 3 cities.
Do you?
A contract.
Well, you got a little problem, for instance, Madam Chairman, in Jordan Valley, which is 100 miles from the county seat. There's a ribbon clerk.
There's a what?
A fellow in North Plains. He deals poker on the side, but he's also the marshal. He has most of his money on the table, and therefore they don't have to pay him anything. He'd be marshal.
Yeah.
Now, if you demand this training, he can't even read. He's fast. It's a difficult thing to translate from Bass to English. I've tried it. But he does function there properly. If he didn't function correctly, they'd hang him. So they're getting along very well. Now, if you make them have a trained police officer, it'd double their city budget.
They don't need one out there anymore.
They have plenty on the table.
Well,
now this is an appropriate point, Madam Chairman. Is it clear that cities can contract with the county sheriff for this service? Is there no doubt about that?
State law.
And Sheriff, won't this encourage it to do more of it?
It could very easily.
I hope it will.
Well, then that'll help our 677 too. This fits right into that, doesn't it?
Further questions. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Martin. John, do we have Senate Bill 10 on also?
No, we don't. I think Judge Lewis wanted to testify on that.
Is there anybody else here who wishes to testify on any of the bills today? Yes, sir?
2219.
Okay.
2219,
Mr. Longstein. That's Dave Frost.
Yeah.
Could you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Stephen Lowenstein, and I'm a private attorney in Portland and a consultant to the Oregon State Bar Committee on Legal Aid. Madam Chairman, shall I hand out copies of the testimony?
Yes, if you would, please.
House Bill 2219 provides for a $2 filing fee in circuit court and a 50-cent filing fee in district court to defray costs of legal aid programs in each county where such a program is organized under the auspices of the Oregon State Bar Association. The bill contains an automatic termination date of July 1, 1975. Legal aid programs in Oregon are being seriously affected by general social service cuts of the national administration. There are currently 6 legal services programs in Oregon financed under various levels from federal sources. 2 of these programs, Clackamas and Linn counties, are currently funded by community action program funds and face complete termination unless alternative funding sources can be found. Jackson County's program, staffed with VISTA lawyers, is in jeopardy, and the major urban programs in Multnomah, Marion, Polk, and Lane counties are confronted with cuts of varying severity. There's an attached profile of these programs showing the extent of the current cuts. House Bill 2219 would provide minimal but crucial funds in an attempt to keep legal aid for the poor at an adequate level. This is only an interim measure to keep existing programs afloat until general funding can be sought under Nixon's proposed National Legal Services Corporation, state and local special revenue sharing, and the next session of the legislature. There seems to be no alternative source of funds to support these programs during the two-year period of transition to new permanent funding. Let me just add here that the funds that will be derived under this bill will not be enough to support any of the programs. But what the hope is that during this interim two-year period that we'll be able to put various types of sort of bit and piece funding together to keep the programs afloat until the permanent funding can come from these alternative sources that are designed to take over from the federal cut. That is, we're getting bits and pieces of general revenue sharing at the moment, and if we can add them to this bill, we can keep most of these, especially smaller programs, afloat, and the larger programs can fill in some of the losses to keep them at a current level. One specific point concerning the bill needs to be made. We would ask that the words "or County Bar Association" be inserted after "Oregon State Bar" on line 7 of section 1. These words were in the bill when it left the House Judiciary Committee, but were omitted merely due to an oversight. The legal counsel to that committee will testify to this effect if thought necessary.
Would you repeat the amendment?
The amendment is for to add the words "or County Bar Association" after "Oregon State Bar" on line 7 of section 1. That was an amendment actually made by the House Judiciary Committee and was just left out due to oversight. The reason for it is that most legal aid programs, in fact, are run under the auspices of county bar associations. And to avoid an extra layer of administration, that would mean having to go to the Oregon State Bar as well as the county bar association, and make the bill internally consistent, because there are several other places that says our county bar association, the word should be added.
Somebody want to move the amendment?
I move it.
Any objection to the amendment? Adoption.
I would add, Madam Chairman, that there are two other merely technical oversights when it came out of the House, and that is on line 4 of page 3, where it says indigency representation fee, as specified in section 3, it should be sections 1 and 3.
I move that technical.
Any objection? So ordered.
And one last one. On line 27 of page 3, it says fundings and it should be findings.
I so move.
Thank you, Senator.
You have to have a memorandum.
Any objection? No order.
I have attached a schedule of funds that are projected to be raised by House Bill 2219 and a current profile.
We have a memorandum over a comment.
The current status of the program. And a recent editorial by James Kilpatrick in the Oregonian concerning the importance.
All right, I have a question.
Senator John Brown.
On the Multnomah County is in the CAP funds, are those the monies that are provided by Multnomah County? As I understood, I was talking to somebody last night who is in a position to know that said that the county had a $30,000 contract with legal aid. Now, where does that show up here?
Well, if I understand it, I don't know how MECA, the Community Action Program, what its relationship with Multnomah County is, but MECA, the Community Action Program for Multnomah County, was providing the East County Office for Multnomah County Legal Aid, and those funds will be cut. Now, Multnomah County may pick up some of those funds in its general revenue share.
The Director of Judicial Services for Multnomah County supervises legal aid to the extent of Multnomah County's $30,000 contract with Multnomah County Legal Aid. And that is Multnomah County general fund money, as I understand it. Does it show here?
Well, I don't know the facts, but as I understood it in exploration of this issue, that it was $25,000 that was provided by MECA, the Community Action Program, which would be cut, and Multnomah County is now considering whether to take some of that over in general revenue sharing. As I understand it, they've made a tentative commitment, a sort of moral commitment, to take, to provide some of those funds to keep the East County office going.
I have one other question.
Two other questions.
You show here 15 attorneys in the legal aid office in Portland, and there are more than that on a full-time basis.
Well,
where are the rest of them?
You know, I have these figures from the director of Multnomah County Legal Aid. Now, they changed during the year. He, initially, we had, I believe, 18, and he lost 3 attorneys through funding cuts. So he changed that to 9 OEO and 6 other. Now, I can't say if there are others. I don't believe there are.
Senator Smith.
Will the $220,000 raised by this bill be sufficient to keep all of the staff indicated in your profile?
They add up to
$220,000.
Yeah, I would think it would just... I figured it out once with prior figures, and we figured it at $70,000.
Well, I have analysis of the proposed legislation for the budget division, the executive department, in front of me. Total additional fee revenues would be $55,000 in total federal funds.
Oh, okay.
You said $165,000, but you're not assured of the federal funds.
No, we're assured of some federal funds. The major programs have been cut only a certain percentage, and the 3 minor programs in the state are going to be cut entirely. Those we're just trying to keep afloat. What we're trying to do with the major programs is simply fill in to keep the level of services at their same current level.
Does that mean we've knocked the 9 OEO members in Multnomah County and saved the 6 others since the OEO program's going out?
No, the OEO program is going to continue in Multnomah County. The cuts are only, as you see, in that fourth column. The loss of the Community Action Program Fund, that's $25,000, the Department of Labor, $15,000, and ATW, $7,000. So the basic grant to Multnomah County is intact, but they're losing, I believe it's 4 lawyers. So their services have to diminish to that extent. All we're trying to do is retain those 4 lawyers so that the level of services can be maintained. So this bill will make, I think, the $55,000 is relatively accurate assessment of how much it will make. It's not a very large amount of money, and in the minor counties, what it will do is it will provide $4,000 or $5,000, which can be added to the amount of general revenue sharing that we can possibly muster in this initial term, and that will keep the program going until hopefully the National Legal Services Corporation will assume funding of it as it should when it's enacted.
Then you'll be back in reducing the fees.
Well, actually, there's automatic termination date. So this will simply end July 1, 1975.
There isn't any place in current law or in here where this money shifts around between counties.
No. It stays in the county. It goes from the county, the court clerk, to the county treasurer, to the director of legal aid in that county.
And this is only in counties where there are present legal aid.
Present legal aid.
What if a county suddenly wants to have a legal aid? Is it built in here?
Well,
like Kearney County might want to set up one in 5 or 6 member staff.
It might be a lot cheaper than asking attorneys to do this on a volunteer basis.
How much in Kearney County?
Because the fees they used to charge them in Kearney County.
It is necessary to have the emergency clause.
It is necessary because most of these cuts come at June 30th of the year.
You know, it's an interesting thing. We have a whole raft of bills in this session to reduce attorney fees. New way of contingent fees, eliminate attorney's fee, the percentage thing in probate cases, to do away with attorney's fees in divorce cases. We have a great citizens lobby that is complaining about higher and higher attorney fees. But it's $58.80 to file for a divorce in Multnomah County now. This will put it up over $60 for filing fee alone. And I I forget what it was when I started in the legislature, but I think it was about $40 in filing fee. Nobody, all the people that are so darn concerned about how much you and I are making as attorneys in private practice on our attorney's fee and want to cut us back, don't seem to be a darn bit concerned about the increased filing fees. And then you look in the Daily Journal of Commerce at the divorce suits filed daily, and it has reached the point now where the Legal Aid Service is representing more petitioners in divorce cases than the private lawyers. So we're shoving the increased filing fee off on to the few remaining people that can afford to pay this. And it's kind of grates against my sense of fairness.
Oh, you know, I agree with you in one sense, and that is that this is not a good way to finance programs. It just isn't. And it's no way, I think, that we want to finance legal aid programs. It's only a very temporary measure. It's a 2-year period. And it's a very well,
they always, that'll be extended in 75.
Well, I hope not, because it really doesn't provide the funds to run legal aid as it should be run. You know, legal aid really needs basic funding from a permanent source. It's had it all the way up to now, and because of the new federalism of the national administration, the patterns are changing, and we have a transition period here. We don't want the programs to die and the services they provide to an awful large number of people out there in the field to die off in the transition period before the new funding sources can be found. I don't think there's any problem with the new funding, unless it's going to be that there will be no legal aid in the future. Then this sort of funding is not going to support legal aid in any case. I believe there will be legal aid in the future, and this will be really unnecessary.
Madam Chairman, I don't think we can attach an emergency clause to this constitutionally, because it's very clearly spelled out that it's a revenue tax. But I wonder if it couldn't be amended so as to make these fees retroactive, provided that they be collected in the interim, but that the fees will be payable retroactively to the effective date.
Well, really. This is not, you know, there's often one gets around the emergency clause provision and things like this, and you say it's a fee, presumably a self-financing or regulating fee. There's no regulation here. This is pure and simply a sales tax on filing fee. And I think that we can't constitutionally attach the emergency clause. I'd like Mr. Winter to check that out with the Department of Revenue, maybe, and see if we can't figure out a nice way to get the money legally.
Senator Smith.
We don't have your total budgets yet. His office.
Where's your
agenda?
Yes. Current funding.
Agenda?
There's just no total. But if we just add up these three columns, that's the current funding of each program. The first three columns on this page. For instance, in Clackamas County, the total funding would be $47,000 plus the $10,000.
That's what it costs
now. That's what it costs now. That's what their program, they estimate
$7,000 now.
To run their program, right. Jackson County, $5,000 plus the VISTA lawyers. Lane County, the $70,000 OEO plus those minimal sums given by the City of Eugene and the Bar Association, Lane County, et cetera. So those are the total funds in each of the programs.
And then, let's see, Jackson County, Clackamas County.
You know, John, maybe a solution here would be, now this sounds awfully reactionary, but to require these people who are receiving, I think they made a proposal like this in England, who are receiving these free services to pay $1 or $2.
They don't have to pay a filing fee now.
Well, we might say, in order to make this possible, maybe I wonder if they couldn't pay $1 or something.
Senator Ivers.
I just
like wondering.
I'm sorry.
I was just looking up the money.
Okay.
So it costs $57,000 in Clackamas County, and you
going to get $1,200 out of this bill.
I have the most recent figures on that printed out by the Supreme Court.
Well, I have it in the budget division executive.
That might be the way to do it.
Okay, what does that say?
It says you're going to get $1,200 and you got a $57,000 program.
$1,200 out of the district court. $3,600
yeah,
circuit court. About $4,800 or so.
That's exactly the figures.
All right. You're right. You're going to get $4,800 for a $57,000 program. Mm-hmm. How are you going to run your program with $5,700?
Well, the hope is to, applications have been made to Clackamas County for general revenue sharing. The hope is that we can put together, applications have been made to UGN also for funding in Clackamas County. The hope is that we can put this small amount of money together, together with the UGN money and general revenue sharing, which I believe will get perhaps $20,000, and we'll keep the program to that level, to the greatest level we can.
In other words,
in
my theory, you might have a $5,700 program as well.
Well, that's a possibility, but I don't think so. I mean, I couldn't run a $5,700 program.
Well, then,
all right.
Then you're asking us to pass this bill when you have no agreement that you're going to get any more money, and you can't run a $5,700 program, so what are you going to do with the money if we pass the bill and you can't get any more?
Well, if there's no program, there won't be any money collected.
You could make the collection conditional on a program, obviously.
But it is already conditional on a program.
In the bill?
In all counties where legal representation is provided for the poor without fee by a legal aid program, and if there's no legal aid program, there would be no collection of the fee.
Well, you're going to collect it by law now.
Only if there's a legal aid program. And if there's no legal aid program, it won't be collected.
Well, they're going to start collecting it right away. And the legal
What would happen if the program ends
out?
I assume they would stop collecting at that point. I mean, maybe that could be made clear. In any case, you know, the problem we have in trying to find funding for these programs is that the county can say the same thing. UGN can say the same thing, that, well, look, you don't have commitments from the others. How do we know you're going to have a program? But the point is, I think the county has just been proving very responsive, as a matter of fact, and very responsible in terms of providing some funds in this interim period. Clackamas County, I believe, is going to provide approximately $20,000. I would hope that we would get this bill and add to that $5,700. And then UGN will make up the difference, I hope.
And
we've got a tentative commitment from UGN that they will help us in Clackamas County. And only by making all these efforts are we able to put it together to keep it going.
Madam Chairman?
What would you think if we were to provide that this could be done on the condition that the legal aid services would make the same minimum charge to their clients upon the filing of a case in circuit or district court?
Well, you know, I don't know what the legal aid services would say. I mean, I'm working for the legal aid committee of the bar. My reaction to that is that it's fairly harsh to make people who are by definition very poor pay a certain sum of money to get into court.
Even if it's only $2 in one case and 50 cents?
Okay, I mean, I would prefer not to do it. I think that they could probably get that money together and pay it. But, I don't know, the purpose of the legal aid program is to help essentially the hardcore poor. And the eligibility standards are very tight indeed. You have to be really quite poor to get service generally. My feeling about it is I don't support that, but I think it's possible.
Well, the problem is, of course, there's no necessary relationship to poverty or wealth in the filing program. I think Senator Burns pointed that out, that people that are poorer than many people getting legal aid will go to a private lawyer and pay a filing fee.
No, well, actually, if they are indigent, they can have that filing fee waived. So it has to be everyone above an indigency standard who pays the filing.
Legal aid isn't simply indigent, so you can get below a certain level, you don't have to be totally penniless.
No, not totally penniless, but darn poor. I think it's $4,200 for a family of four.
Talk to Aaron Brown about what legal aid did to his practice out of Williamson Russell. I'm serious. If you know it.
Mr. Bonas, did you wish me?
Yes, I
have.
Madam Chairman, I'm Mr.
Bonas.
I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland, and I'm also secretary of the Legal Aid Committee for the Oregon State Bar.
Senator, in answer to your question, I practiced on union in Alberta.
Anymore, do you, Bob?
Not anymore, because neither does Aaron.
That's why he's now a legal aid.
Even smarter than I am, he became a judge. But
he's not with legal aid.
I know.
No,
I know.
I'm kidding.
I thought about going. In answer to that question, I think that's erroneous. I practiced in the same general area for 9 years, the same general area that Aaron practiced in. And if I would have had the monetary facilities, truthfully, to modernize the building I was in the manner I wanted to do it, I'd probably still be there. The greatest thing that happened to my practice was legal aid, as far as I'm concerned, because at that time, as a member of the bar, I was a sole practitioner. Indigents have come to me. I feel real guilty about turning them out. And I think a few of you on the committee anyway, know my propensity to take losers. And as a consequence, my practice and my income really suffered. When legal aid came and moved into Killingsworth, and I could send them down there, my income went up, I'd say, by about a third. That was the greatest thing that happened in my practice, as far as I'm concerned.
Senator Irish.
Well, I was just wondering, I guess, this extreme column of that. Now, those are the number of cases handled by legal aid. Is that what we're talking about?
In the last year, yeah.
All right. Now, what I would like to know, just in kind of round figures, what are most of these cases, what type of, are these divorce cases, most of them?
I think the estimate is that about 40% of them are what they call family law cases. That includes divorce and custody problems, other sorts of adoptions. Now, I could get those figures for you.
No, I was just wondering about the divorce part or the family problems. And
right. A number of them are landlord-tenant cases and minor consumer problems.
All right. One more, Madam Chair. As between plaintiff and defendant-type cases, do you have any figures on that, whether they are being defended or where they are going out aggressively getting into court?
In all cases, not just
divorce. Right.
I really don't have those figures, although I could get them. I think they're kept for OEO in any case. I believe I can get them. I think in the preponderance of cases, they're in a defendant position, except perhaps in divorce.
Aside from divorce, or probably they would be,
from my experience,
primarily defense.
Maybe 90% are in a defendant position.
Isn't it in the divorce field that probably costs a small practitioner more than anything else? Because it used to be, I mean, it's an odd thing. If the only way they can get a divorce is by getting the money, they almost always are able to raise it. Now they go to legal aid.
Just one more question.
Yes,
right. Now, the programs you talk about are programs to hire attorneys.
I would have into their programs to serve before.
Well, the money is used to hire attorneys.
Yes, the money is used to hire attorneys,
right,
secretaries, and then support
and
needed.
The staff.
Yes.
All right. So the program is to provide legal service to the poor.
To the poor.
That's to hire attorneys.
And I might say that the salary levels of the attorneys are not high.
Don't you also have some Vista attorneys?
Yes, there are some other sorts of attorneys who can come in. That's why it says, like, Multnomah County 9, OEO, 6 others, some Vista attorneys, some other sorts of programs that provide attorneys.
Senator, in answer to your question, I think it would encompass a larger frame than that. And I think in some counties, if a nonprofit organization was created to perform legal service for the indigent and was volunteer staff of, say, attorneys in the county, I think the funds could go to just staff an office. In other words, have the secretarial. In other words, instead of just drawing on the, not only drawing on the private attorneys, but drawing on their staff, that these funds could be used to create a staff to serve them, the volunteer attorneys, rather than pay attorneys fees. I think some counties may be in a position.
Well,
where
this is a subsidization of private attorneys, is what you're saying.
Yeah. No.
Take care of it.
There are some counties where the only legal aid they have is private attorneys.
Senator Keithbrook.
Are we talking about a total amount here of $55,400?
Yeah.
I can't conceive of any less efficient way to raise so little money than this, other than going out on the street corner and putting cops.
I know. In a way, we're just quite desperate in this industry.
I know. I would much rather fight like hell down here, ways and means, to get $55,400 and pay it to them. And this thing here, you know, every time they file it, they got the little form there, the library, and this, and so forth. And they're going to, in Linn County, you're going to collect $1,266 by this method. And they're going to have the damn form they fill out, and administering that money, and tracing it through, keeping records on it. It's just, I know you're desperate for money. I don't follow that, but I just, and you know that this has been a traditional way when we fund the law library and different things.
All the mechanism is set up already. I mean, they collect filing fees. It's not like a new mechanism has to be set up. It's
I finance my campaign by selling beer and hot dogs, you know, and you could take the members of the bar and have one big bash and raise that much money.
To be quite frank, you know, the Legal Aid Committee does everything it possibly can to raise funds, and we're making every effort possible.
How many attorneys in the state?
Too bad, man.
3,700.
That's your opinion, make a lot of money.
30 bucks
a piece.
Listen,
wait a minute.
The Bar Association took this board out.
Nobody has a bill for that.
This gives me a chance to put another gripe about 2004. The governor spent all the money for revenue sharing. They really ought to go on for this type of stuff. It was a categorical advance. And I agree with you, Keith. By Jove, that's where some of that money ought to go on. To fill in the holes that somebody pulled the plug out on.
Well, address your remarks to Judge Brancher.
No, he's my friend. I can't do that.
Madam Chairman,
tell the governor
that. Well, it seems to me that, you know, later in the session, we could always repeal it. It does seem like it's a desperate situation, and we ought to provide even a bad method. And I really certainly wouldn't want to throw into the wolves of Ways and Means.
Well, I feel it.
And so, of course, if Ways and Means does come up with the money, they can repeal this as a part of their bill. But at least this would be a guaranteed source of funds. So.
Any other questions of these gentlemen? Thank you.
Thank you.
You want to motion on this, or do you want to wait?
I think we'll wait. What bill did you want, sir?
House Bill 2099, minor in the deal.
You know, under the old abundant food program, when they used to go in to get abundant food, they had to pay a buck or something.
Have a chair.
I think it probably could. I don't know how much money that'd bring in. Maybe we should ask them.
Well, maybe if they're a little more selective in some of their cases, they wouldn't need something.
Oh, I think they are.
I'll buy it.
Weed them out, probably.
$85.15 to the governor is getting so pretty soon to about $90.10. These 10 are funding everything, including getting sued against
the world. How in the bar committee come up with all these plaintiffs' bills?
Yeah, this is a good bill. We want to get this out.
I don't think they're necessarily plaintiffs' bills.
Just state your name for the record, please. I don't know.
Cut down litigation.
Myron Enfield. I'm an attorney in Salem, Oregon. I'm a member of the Practice Procedure Committee of the Oregon State Bar. Mr. Sahlstrom of Eugene had intended to be here and called me just about 2 hours ago that he could not be here. And I'm filling in for him. Appearing here on House Bill 2099, which is to allow a plaintiff in a personal injury action to discover the amount of the liability insurance coverage applicable in the case. Been some mention that this is a plaintiff's bill. This one in particular, I think, maybe is a plaintiff's bill. I think that it is also a defendant's bill in a way, because it puts out in the open what the principal asset is that you're talking about in many personal injury cases here. Not talking about some nebulous thing anymore if we have discovery as to whether it's 10 or 25 or 50 or 100. This bill was approved by the membership of the bar at the annual convention, and I think there are other bills that we have approved, for instance, that do the same thing on the defendant's side, namely the discovery of medical reports on the part of the defendant.
That hasn't been approved by this committee.
All right. Maybe it hasn't been approved by this committee, but I think there is a balance that facilitates discovery on each side, and I simply say that. Mm-hmm.
That might be a bargaining point.
I'm not sure it's a bargaining point. I think it's an improvement of the information that each party has before you go into legal, before you go into a lawsuit. And I think that's what the whole system of justice is aimed at. It's not a matter of gamesmanship anymore. I hope it is not. It's a matter of being fully informed. I think it would be a benefit to parties in litigation to have this bill passed.
This committee believes in the sporting theory of justice.
Did you hear what he said, Keith? Did you hear what he said?
The bargaining point?
Well, no. Do away with gamesmanship. Your comments on the sporting theory of justice.
Madam Chairman.
Isn't
it a fact that when we think of defendants as being individuals and not insurance companies, this actually might, in many cases, be a defendant's bill.
That's right.
Because then the insurance company then is supposed to deal with the plaintiff based on a known fact rather than playing games, which could conceivably result under some circumstances if there were an inexperienced plaintiff's lawyer who didn't know really what he was doing, and it can get very technical, who didn't really lay the groundwork for an excess judgment, this could end up hurting a defendant in one way or another.
I would agree with you, Senator Cook. I do not believe it would be in a majority of cases, but I think there are certainly places where it would be a defendant's bill as well as a plaintiff's bill. I don't think it's totally a defendant's bill. It's essentially a plaintiff's bill.
Well, that's right. The point is you'd get trapped. If the plaintiff, let's say, and I'm certainly not the most skilled plaintiff's lawyer in the world, and I know I've made defective demands trying to get at excess. I'm sure there are others who know less about it than I do. And so if they didn't know what the coverage was, unless they really lay the groundwork, they don't really put the insurance company in the spot to force them to disgorge and make a settlement for what they have. And so you could end up, theoretically, with a judgment being obtained against an individual defendant in excess of his insurance limits, and he'd have to pay it himself.
That's right.
Whereas if it were disclosed, then it's known.
Madam Chair,
you don't have to play games.
Then what would be the argument not to disclose it to the jury as well?
Well, the jury is only determining the facts. Here we're talking about bargaining. And the jury's not supposed to bargain. Supposedly the jury's supposed to bring in a verdict for whatever they do.
So they're still going to bring in the excess?
No, they can't under this, either way.
I wonder what
this
the effect
that
this would have on
it.
Franklin.
Oh, no, I know, but I think it's still
for
the judgment.
What was your question?
Well, you know, the Franklin Life case, I think, is the leading case on excess. And I wonder what effect this would have on the excess question.
The thing, you know,
I think the effect it would have on the excess question is that, as Senator Cook has alluded to here, the excess question would come up with less frequency because you're going to have on the table what the coverage is. Other than that, I do not believe it would affect the excess question. It will diminish them in number.
Senator Keith,
I think it can have some effect on the number of cases tried. I think it can create more fairness for both parties because a lot of times you don't know whether or not to make a policy limit demand because you don't know what the policy limit is in a lot of instances. And and sometimes you make a policy limit demand and that ends that lawsuit in a hurry.
This
but you don't know.
Sure.
You don't know how much is there. And there's different qualities in different adjusters on behalf of insurance companies. And in particular, when you got an insurance company that has very few policyholders in the state, or maybe it's somebody that just happened to be going through the state, and then they try to adjust the thing from some office by correspondence and various other things, and this would equalize that to a very great extent.
I might also say that this is...
Don't you think?
Yes, I think so.
Isn't that so?
The federal courts, do they not require disclosure
right.
now?
That's right. They
you
do.
Get in federal court, in a case in federal courts, the federal courts require this disclosure.
Right.
It's only
it
a question whether the state courts.
I'd
like to know, Madam Chairman, the federal court, does it require the man to give a balance sheet to them?
Nope.
Well, why not? What's the insurance and the balance sheet? They're both on the same thing. What are his assets to cover this particular liability? And I don't see why you don't put the balance sheet in here. This is a funny kind of a business, I think.
Well, I agree with that comment. In some ways, it's plenty kind of a business. But you'll find in dealing with these claims, and I'm sure the lawyers upon your committee will agree with me, that you will find all kinds of coverage from very minimum to very maximum. And your insurance company, if it's a serious injury, for instance, the lawyer or any reasonable person would expect a value of $40,000 or $50,000 above. The insurance company might say, well, we got some chance of winning it. Not very good, but some. But we've only got a $20,000 policy coverage. Let's just gamble. Let's see if we just can't win on it. Well, they're not gambling with their money alone. They're gambling with the policyholder's money, is what they're doing. And that's, I think, an entirely different thing than if the person has substantial assets in his own name. You can do some investigation to find out what they are.
Well, I can't let that go unchallenged because it isn't fair to say that they're gambling with policyholders' money because they write, they customarily advise the defendant, the insured, that it's quite likely is an excess problem involved. And I always do encourage them to get their own attorney and explain very, very meticulously to them what the consequences are.
I have been there likewise, Senator Burns. I have written those letters telling them they should have their own attorneys and all of these things. But nevertheless, I think that insurance company should be adjusting that loss as if they had a policy that was equal in amount to what prayer that complaint says. If it says $275,000, I think they have to look at it as if that is what the prayer, what the coverage was. And many of them do not. Now, if they take that letter at face value and they go get their own attorney to represent their excess, if this is always done, I have no quibble with you. I think then you will almost always reach a good, proper, fair result. But many of those people read that letter from you and from me and say, gosh, that's what I bought insurance for, to have those people investigated and to hire me a lawyer. And now he's saying, hire my own lawyer. I say this, I represent plaintiffs and I represent defendants. I don't have a corner either way, probably more plaintiffs than defendants at the present time. If they always went and got their own lawyer, I'd be inclined to agree with you.
Well, my point is, you and I don't do our job unless we adequately and very emphatically explain the consequences to them, and if there is going to be an excess question, see to it that they have some independent counsel.
No, I disagree with you. I am sure that I have had cases where I did my job, and those people, I cannot force them to get independent counsel. I can urge them to. I can tell them the consequences if they don't. I can tell them why they should. I cannot force them to get independent counsel. And I can think of some who did not. I can think of some who, end result, proved they didn't need to. I can think of some of those others, too, that should have.
Madam Chairman, it seems like this discussion is certainly strong endorsement for no-fault insurance.
Thank you.
You got a bill on that, too?
Yeah.
Huh? Do you?
Sure.
Well, it's been years. I
got one in
here. I don't know why I asked.
For the question, with Mr. Enfield. Thank you, Mr. Enfield.
Thank you.
Mr. Brandfield, did you come on 10 today?
Pardon?
Did you come on Senate Bill 10 today?
No. John indicated that would be next Wednesday.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
Just had nothing
else
to do.
May I ask a question on Senate Bill 10, though?
As drawn, and probably where it would require that the court approve the plan, do you insist on that language?
Anything that gets it through.
If you don't mind, I will suggest an amendment.
If you can approve upon it, I'd be delighted.
Okay. Well, based on some conversations that Kathleen and I have had.
Very good. I'd be delighted.
Thank you.
Anything else to come up?
Just two of them. No, that's all right. Go ahead. All right, that's a hell of a deal, isn't it?
2099.
Yeah, well, just listening to it. What you're really trying to do is just to get the last dollar out of the insurance company. Now, that's the best in gamesmanship I ever heard of.
Well, there's another bill we've had that was disclosed to the jury what they did.
Yes, sir. I believe the disclosure on the facts, but that seems like